You're listening to the Skift podcast. Today, we feature a conversation that took place on stage at the inaugural Skift India Summit this week in New Delhi, India. In this conversation, Air India CEO and Managing Director Campbell Wilson speaks with Skift Asia editor Peden Bhutia about connecting India to the world. For more like this, visit live.skift.com to learn how you can attend our next industry-defining live event. Enjoy the conversation.
Please join us in welcoming CEO and Managing Director of Air India, Campbell Wilson, in discussion with Skift Asia editor Peden Bhutia.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for braving the early morning Gurgaon traffic and coming here. Thank you very much for everything. Welcome, Campbell. A very long drive. Campbell lives very nearby, right here. Campbell, let me just begin with the questions first. You've been in Air India for almost 2 years now. Mm-hmm. June, you complete 2 years. So how has your intention and goals change from what they were then to what it is now?
I think the goals themselves haven't changed. The intention and the ambition always was to restore Air India to being a top-tier world-class airline. They've been refined a little bit along the way and quantified and clarified and put into a sequence of activities. But I think really, this whole transformation took off probably about 18 months ago when we launched our Vihan program, which is a five-year transformation. The first 6 months was really triage, trying to address all of the accumulated sins of the past and clean up so we could at least look forward. Then the subsequent year, which is just about to finish, has been about putting a lot of the foundations, whether it be systems, people, processes, premises, equipment, in place to really enable us now to take that bold leap forward and bring Air India to where we want it to be.
Mm-hmm. Also, Campbell, you know, now that Singapore has given the green light for Vistara's merger, I think Singapore will share about 25.1% share of the enlarged Air India group. So what exactly is the future of Vistara? And as a very concerned Club Vistara member, what is the future of Club Vistara, the loyalty program?
Goodness. Well, maybe I can give a little bit broader context first. At the time of privatization, the Tata Sons conglomerate owned Air India, Air India Express, Air Asia India, and 51% share of Vistara. In addition to transforming Air India, we are also in the process of merging the two low-cost airlines and the two full-service airlines. As a consequence of all of that merger activity, we end up with an enlarged Air India group, mm-hmm. and subject to legal approvals, Singapore Airlines will get a 25.1% share in that enlarged entity. Yeah. The planning of the LCC side, in fact, the execution of the LCC side is almost complete. There's a single management team, single brand, operating with a singular purpose, and really the only steps yet to complete are the legal and regulatory closure. For the full-service carrier, we have received all of the competition clearances, so our teams are now working together, sharing information, planning on what the combined entity looks like, and we're about to start the process of actually bringing the teams physically together behind the scenes in order to operate the combined airline with a consistent focus. From a customer perspective, it will be some time before the merger is fully effected. You know, we're fully aware that Vistara has spent 9 years building itself into a high-quality, well-respected airline, including the Club Vistara program, and it would just not be sensible for us to do anything to damage that prematurely. So we will be working very hard to raise Air India's game so that when the actual brand merger and customer-facing merger happens, people don't notice the difference. So behind-the-scenes planning is underway, the regulatory and legal is in process, the customer-facing elements will take some time, and we're not rushing it.
So will Vistara still remain, or will it now be just Air India?
No, I think we've been very clear that Vistara, in the long term, will become Air India. The Air India brand is 92 years old. It is recognized around the world. It has a very strong, if recently tarnished, heritage. But Air India is the nation's brand. And so I think it would be foolish for us not to play on that strength. Now, Vistara has a very, very strong reputation and very strong awareness in India, but not so much globally. So yes, we want to maintain elements of Vistara in the future Air India. They will certainly be there in people and process. They're there in some respect in our new brand attributes. A lot of the things that we are doing are modeled on what Vistara does. But we will eventually be collapsing the two. As I say, we won't be rushing it, probably sometime later this year, sometime next year.
You spoke about, you spoke about Air India's legacy, but yet, you call Air India a startup airline. You've been quoted calling Air India a startup airline. Now, if I look at startups, startups are supposed to be nimble, agile, adaptable, and of course, a great focus on digital innovation because they want to disrupt the status quo. So how is Air India doing that? I know that there is a digital revamp going on, much needed digital revamp. So how is Air India doing all of that?
Well, I've described it as a startup because really it had had decades of underinvestment. I think I'd spoken previously that the email system in the company was so dysfunctional that people used Gmail. We were the last airline in the world on a particular passenger service reservation system, the owner of which shut down and kicked us off. We were the last company in the world on a particular SAP enterprise resource management platform. So from an IT perspective, it just had to be completely rebuilt from scratch. The luxury of doing it all together, all at once now, is that we can be best of class with latest technology and integrate it very well, that a legacy operator with many different generations of systems can't quite so easily do. Now, in terms of people, there had been no recruitment of non-flying people for 15 years. The average age was 54 with a retirement age of 58. We've been able to inject a whole bunch of new people into business by necessity, but also for their competency, and bring the average age from 54 down to 35.
What are you doing with the 54-year-olds?
Well, so many of them, average age of 54 going to 58, many of them are retiring every month to the extent that we've tried to help people with this transition, because transitioning from government way of working to private sector way of working is traumatic for people sometimes. And so we'd offer people voluntary retirement, and a couple of thousand people have taken that. So it's been a transition that has been very smooth, very consensual, but also hugely transformative in terms of culture and capabilities. And so the IT people, I mean, there are many other examples, but in so many dimensions, we are as much a startup as we are a transformation.
So, Kamal, you talked about the revamp, and if I, how could I not mention your 470 plane order that made headlines all over the world? So, but are Air India's, you have about 220 plane order with Boeing. So are these plane orders affected by the security and the production issues at Boeing? And do you think you're getting your planes later than you had planned for?
Well, maybe let me, again, step back a little bit. 470 is what we purchased. In addition to that, we've leased 36 aircraft. And in addition to that, we had 30 aircraft that had been long grounded because the prior Air India didn't have the money to buy spare parts. And so they were being cannibalized to keep other aircraft flying. So if you look at the net increase in the number of aircraft available to us, it's well in the 550 sort of range. And so that is powering a rate of growth which is almost unprecedented, I think, in the industry. We're taking a new aircraft every 6 days. We have for the last 6 months, and we'll continue to do so for probably the next 12. And you can just imagine that scale of growth and what needs to come together in the organization to support that safely and commercially successfully, as well as administratively. Now, some of the aircraft that we've acquired being leased already exist. And so there have been some teething challenges with those, because post pandemic, MRO capacity, paint shop capacity, was constrained. So those have taken a little bit longer to get into service. But as of this month, we've taken all 11 of the new 777s that we had leased in. We've got three of the six new A350s that we have procured. We've got, I believe, 15 or 16 of the 737 MAXs which had been built for someone else that we took over the contract. So from that perspective, there's been a good inflow of aircraft, as I say, one every 6 days. Moving forward, there's always supply chain risk in this industry, and especially as we come out of COVID, and especially as the manufacturers themselves ramp up. Seat constraints, other component constraints, in some cases engine constraints. You know, this is just part and parcel of our industry that we are, we're at the receiving end of a mm-hmm. very, very long supply chain, and we just have to be nimble and agile to cope.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about aircraft, you know, what plans do you have for the B777-9s? Will it be serving the North America market, or are you looking at it from a cargo perspective? And when do we expect to get the first aircraft?
Well, we have an option for the 777-9s. We haven't committed to the contract, or haven't committed to the purchase of that particular aircraft. Presently, it's a 787 contract. We'll make the call sometime in the future. But the intention is, this is a large, long-range aircraft. It has plenty of real estate to do a special product and a special product that is befitting of a long-haul market. So probably a North America operation, and mm-hmm. certainly a passenger operation. But clearly there's a big belly hold cargo
so
space.
So you are looking at it from a passenger operation.
Absolutely.
Okay. Campbell, what is your view on, you know, when we are talking about access, protectionism versus open skies, you know? Of course, there are many Middle Eastern carriers that want to increase seat capacity from India. Dubai, for instance, I think wants 50,000 seats. And Jazeera Airlines had said that they want their weekly cap to be increased from 12,000 to about 28,000. And there are many other airlines that want to fly into India. So protectionism versus open skies, what is your viewpoint on that? Because the Indian aviation minister has said that he wants to develop India as a global aviation hub.
Well, it's not a binary choice. I think the right policy depends on where the country is in its own development cycle. You know, it's no wonder that some relatively small geographies or population bases want to tap larger, faster-growing ones to augment what they don't have themselves. You know, with respect to some of the places that you mentioned, they wouldn't even make the top 20 in terms of, you know, population of city. In the India context. So it's no wonder they want to tap India's population and growth. And then we also have to look, how many people are actually going to that city as opposed to going through that city? In the cases you cite, you're upwards of 70 to 90% of people are not going to that place, they're going through that place. Those passengers can be served by an Indian carrier, or indeed a carrier from the ultimate destination market. And I think given the state of Indian airlines and the fact that they're very nascent and newly privatized, and the market is developing professional modality, I think it's appropriate for India that time be accorded for the maturity to come, for the growth to come, for the 470 aircraft that we've purchased to come, and for us to connect India non-stop to many places around the world, so people have a much faster, much more convenient, much less emissive way to get from A to B.
I don't want to put you in a spot, but if you could choose one hub, for a global network, which one would it be, Delhi or Bombay?
Well, I don't think we need to choose one. I think we have the luxury of many opportunities. This is the wonder of India. You uh-huh. saw Rafat's statistics. India can be home of at least three hubs. And in addition to those three hubs, plenty of point-to-point services. Really, there is not many markets like India in the world. If you take continental Europe, that's probably a similar sort of market. If you take North America, that's a similar sort of market. Beyond that, China maybe. There's less than a handful of markets that offer the same opportunity here. So Northern India, I think, has a good east-west flow. Mm-hmm. I think Southern India has a good Asia to Africa, or even Australasia to Europe flow. In addition to which, of course, there's huge third, fourth traffic and opportunity too.
So you would want hubs in at least three different places?
Certainly more than two.
Okay. If you have to talk about, when we are talking about building a global hub, we cannot disregard the fact that there is a severe competition posed by the Middle Eastern carriers. You know, how do you compete with you know, the free stays that Etihad gives, you know, or Saudia gives, and the free visas, and of course the transit visas, right? And then of course, I think last week Turkish announced that, you know, anybody flying in, flying to India or flying from India to another hub can stay free in Istanbul. So how does Air India compete with something like that?
Well, there are some things you can compete with and some things you can't, because some things are also not funded by the airline. You know, in some of these cases, there's, you know, highly vertically integrated P&L that includes more than just the airline in the ecosystem. And that's fine. That's a matter of national policy. We don't operate in that environment here, which I believe is why it's also not appropriate to, you know, have a freely open doors for any comer. We have to work with private sector airports. We have to work with you know, state regulators and border agents that, you know, are not yet perhaps fully cognizant of customer experience as a metric of performance. You know, and everyone's trying hard, but India is coming from a different place with a different environment and sort of level of cohesion. How do we compete with it? Well, I think increasing, you know, improving product, obviously, improving connectivity, fly more places, improving brand, reputation, technology, service, loyalty program. I mean, it's not convenient to get on a flight for 3 or 4 hours, land in the, you know, wee hours of the morning, sit in an airport for an hour and a half or 2 hours or 3 hours or longer, and then get on another flight to get to Europe when you could have gone nonstop in 8.5 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if we can get the basics right and be a credible airline, of course, we're not going to get every person in the market, but I think we're going to get the time-sensitive, the discerning, the premium traveler who values the experience that we're going to be able to provide.
Well, that was about international competition. Let's come closer home. When we talk about domestic competition, you know, IndiGo shares about 60% of the domestic market share in 2023 numbers I'm talking about. And the Tata India Group Airlines, you have a little less than 30% share. Of course, that's almost, you know, like 50% of what IndiGo is. But you also have about 200 plus Airbus Neos in order. And you have decided that you're going to power them with CFM engines. And IndiGo is going with Pratt & Whitney. And we know the issues that you know, Pratt & Whitney is facing. So do you see that decision giving you a competitive advantage over IndiGo in the next few years?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, you know, we make decisions on power plant and airframes on multiple dimensions, because these assets are going to be with us for 12, 20 years, depending on the aircraft type. And so, you know, sadly, there's a history of whether it's airframes or engine manufacturers all having their troubles depending on when you look. And so it's unfortunate that Pratt & Whitney are having some troubles now. We chose CFM because actually they were already supporting our narrow-body fleet, and so it made sense to enlarge the pool of engines for efficiencies perspective. But I think, to go back to your broader point on LCC, you know, bear in mind that the Air India's LCC, the domestic part of it, was only 25 aircraft 2 years ago. In 12 months' time, it will be 100 aircraft. So we're investing a lot into this space. And so I think that one of the luxuries of the Air India Group is that we do have the full service proposition, and we do have the low cost proposition, so we can put the right business model in the right place to serve the market. Now, domestic India is largely going to be LCC, but there's certainly routes that can support a full service proposition. The Metro Triangle, the routes that have high international defeed or feed. But really, I think our opportunity is in that international full-service space, particularly medium and long haul, where India has not been well served by Indian carriers simply because we didn't have the fleet, didn't have the capital, didn't have the ability to plan long term. At the point of privatization, Air India operated all of the wide-body commercial aircraft in India, and that was only 43 aircraft for a population of 1.3 billion, 1.4 billion. Yeah. Singapore has 150 wide-body aircraft. Dubai has 250 wide-body aircraft. You know, that gives you a sense of how grossly underserved the Indian market was by Indian Airlines. And that is the opportunity that we're working to pursue, and that's why we're making aircraft orders of the size we are.
When we talk of opportunities, of course, you know, you heard Rafat, what Rafat said in the morning, and you know, India's, you know, the rising middle class and the economy growing, and in the Indian aviation market, for instance, it's like the third largest and the fastest growing aviation market in the world right now. So, as you know, you have two full service carriers, and with the merger, with the Vistara Air India merger, you will be left with the only full service carrier in the country, unless, you know, we hear occasional reports of Jet resurrecting, unless that happens, but you will be the only one. So what is the opportunity for Air India in this India story?
I think principally it's about the growth opportunity. India is going to add another India in GDP by 2030 if you look at the forecasts. That is huge. It's going to be third or fifth, depending how you draw it, largest travel market in the world. It's already not served well enough. So I think whilst we always worry about and look at competition, we need to be more concerned about being ready for and able to tap the broader opportunity that exists in the growth of aviation or travel in India. And as I say, the international opportunity is staring everyone in the face, given the relative size of fleets and connectivity that India enjoys, unfortunately, or doesn't enjoy, relative to the size of the opportunity. So I don't think we need to be too concerned about where the growth is coming. It's more concerned about, can we serve the growth fast enough and to a standard that the customer expects?
Yeah, when you talk about serving the market, of course there has been a lot of changes in Air India, but that's been gradual, and as part of the Vihan program that you've talked about, and when the mergers happen, right now the LCCs have already been merged, right? The Air India Express and Air Asia.
In all but the legal and regulatory aspects, single mm-hmm. management, single brand, Singapore, single strategy, it's all operating as one.
So you have this two-pronged strategy about LCCs and full-service carriers, So could you talk a little bit more about how you plan? Because I know that in some markets where Air India was flying, now we see Air India Express coming in. So how do you plan to serve that? Because, we have been talking about the growth coming from the tier two and tier three cities of India.
Well, I think it is still a price sensitive market for the most part. The sheer scale of growth, is evidence that there are many people who didn't previously fly now flying. And so it's natural that when they fly, their first consideration is probably going to be safety, then price. And so the majority of the growth domestically is going to be in the LCC side of the business. But as I say, there are still routes in which there is a need for full service. There are still people that wish to fly full service. The same people might fly full service or low cost depending on who is paying or why they're going. So I think we're in this position where we can deploy the right tool for the right job. It may well be that an 8 a.m. or a 5 p.m. flight, very clearly a business-oriented timing, so that's the full-service carrier. Maybe 11 a.m. or 1 p.m. is more leisure-oriented. So we have that flexibility.
So you're not concentrating on the fact that, you would like the full-service carriers to cater to a certain market and the low-cost carriers would go to the interiors. Is it not that?
Well, I think generally speaking, the low-cost carrier is going to be one that's serving the more developmental, more price-conscious, more leisure-oriented markets. But essentially what I'm saying is that we have the flexibility to change on a dime depending on what the market and the people require.
I think we have some questions coming in from the audience. I would like to take this question about what strategies is Air India implementing to surpass competitors like IndiGo in terms of punctuality and reliability of flight schedules?
Yeah. So look, there's no magic bullet to this sort of issue. We have an aircraft fleet that has been maintained safely, but it's not being kept fully up to date in terms of modern componentry and other things. So and just the age is such that the aircraft themselves are not as reliable as a fleet of new aircraft. That will progressively get resolved as we induct more aircraft. And as I say, we're getting one every 6 days. And at the same time as we get one every 6 days, these come with new product, And then we're also putting all of our existing wide bodies through a full refit program. So by the end of 2025, early 2026, you know, all of our wide body aircraft will be have been upgraded. In addition to aircraft health, there's a lot of systems that we need to put in place. You know, IT systems that talk to each other, maintenance planning systems, rostering systems, disruption management systems, passenger handling systems. So a lot of these are now coming into place and being properly integrated, and then we have to start using them more effectively. Then there's people, and people that have the right skills, that understand how to run a complex multi-hub airline. That wasn't really present in the old Air India. We're having to bring that, train it, put it into place. And then finally, there's incentive. In a non-private sector organization, there were no job descriptions. There were no metrics of success. Mm-hmm. There were no rewards for doing well. There were no consequences for not doing well. And so you end up with an organization where there is a malaise and a sort of waikia. Now, we have to change the culture. We are changing the culture so that it is a performance-oriented airline that takes things like OTP and punctuality and service seriously. And that's not an easy lift, but the people have really risen to the occasion. And this huge ingestion of 5,000 people over the last 18 months, 2 years, is really helping catalyze the change.
Okay, so we are going to get punctual airlines, for sure.
Well, it's not just the airline's responsibility. I need to call out here air traffic control.
Yeah,
I need to call out airports.
Yes.
I need to call out a lot of different players.
Absolutely. I think Rafat has a question.
Speaking of your culture, one of the ways I used to describe Air India before Tata bought it is every time you fly Air India, it feels like this is the first time they've ever operated a flight. It felt like that. They didn't know where you should go, what you should do. So hopefully that, I know you want to change. I have the most important question for you. Is Maharaja gone forever? Is it part of it? Is there some part is going to stay? That's what all of us want to know. We were sad when it went, when we heard the news. But can you please finally put to rest any rumors or not?
Well, the rumors of the Maharaja's death were greatly exaggerated. No, I've been very clear that the Maharaja does have a place in the future in India. It has a place in a few dimensions. One, in terms of an ethos of service and of culture and of hospitality and of warmth. Secondly, it may have a future in terms of name. There are various applications of the Maharaja name that make perfect sense, but I won't let any cats out of the bag. And thirdly, as a physical device. I think we've shown on the A350, very nice serviceware, glassware, cutlery, that uses an elevated, stylistic form of the Maharaja to really denote class. It's not going to be mass market cartoon Mickey Mouse application. This is not that airline anymore. But Maharaja has a place and deserves a place, but it must be the right place.
So the Maharaja stays on, and now we need to leave. Thank you so much, Campbell, for this.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
This has been the Skift Podcast. Thank you for listening.